Coming up right now is the Space Show, and a different theme tonight for a reason. And that from 1983 is the Ventures with Columbia. And we'll be talking about the Columbia Space Shuttle later in the show. Welcome to the Space Show, presented by members of the Space Association of Australia. Hello, I'm Andrew Rennie. And Richard, not turning the mic on at the moment, is on the control panel. What's on tonight? Well, we're going to be turning back time.
If I could turn back time, if I could find a way, baby, if I could turn back time, if I could find a way, if I could turn back time, if I could turn back time.
Well, we here on the Space Show can turn back time, and we're going to be winding the clock back to various events, and we celebrate the anniversary of these during April. So let's go to 1946, April the 16th. That was 80 years ago. What happened? Well, in the closing days of World War II, the United States Army seized complete V-2 missiles in Germany, as well as sufficient parts to have 100 rockets. They were shipped to the United States, where they were taken to White Sands in New Mexico. In all, 64 were launched on test and scientific missions. The first launch from White Sands occurred 80 years ago, on 1946, April the 16th. Now, this feature describes the V-2 operations at White Sands.
Summer 1950. On a quiet beach on the coast of Florida, a rocket is readied for launch at a newly built launch site. The rocket is called Bumperwack, and it's been created from a German V-2 missile by a team of scientists, soldiers, and aerospace experts who have turned this weapon of war into a powerful research tool. The launch of a Bumperwack rocket in July 1950 is the first flight from America's Cape Canaveral launch range, capping a research program that began with the end of World War II as German rocket technology and talent arrived in the United States. The story of the rocket that would eventually be known as the V-2 began in the early 1930s. The German Army chose to support the work of the country's small but enthusiastic rocketry clubs, eventually bringing key members of these groups under direct military supervision. Among their members was a talented young engineer, Werner von Braun, who had not yet even graduated from engineering school. Von Braun would go on to lead the technical team that designed the A-4 rocket. After years of development, the A-4 finally flew successfully in October of 1942. The rocket was soon pressed into battle, becoming the world's first ballistic missile. Designed to carry a one-ton warhead to a target 200 miles away, the A4 was used against the cities of London, Paris, and Antwerp, killing over 2,700 in London alone. The Nazi leadership recognized the potential of the A4 as a terror weapon and renamed the missile the V2, or Vengeance Weapon Number 2. While the V2 represented a huge leap in technology and was greatly feared as a weapon of terror, it was a failure as a tactical tool on the battlefield. The rocket was ruinously expensive. No other single weapon project pursued by the Third Reich consumed more time, money, or material resources, and the demands of the weapon did not decrease once missiles reached the battlefield. 30 tons of potatoes were required to produce the alcohol needed for a single V2 launch, robbing Germany's population of much-needed food supplies at the end of the war. Historians have suggested that 24,000 aircraft could have been built instead of the V2's estimated production of only 6,000 missiles. Perhaps the most shocking statistic is that the V2 killed more people during development and production than died from the missile's use as a weapon, largely due to the horrific conditions at the infamous Middlework production plant. As Nazi Germany began to collapse under the advance of Allied forces, a scramble to seize the secrets of the V2 rocket erupted. American, British, and Soviet teams scoured the country searching for V2 parts, technical documentation, and most importantly, the teams that had developed the missile. Von Braun and his team had wisely anticipated this demand for their expertise. One member of the group is alleged to have said, "We despise the French. We are mortally afraid of the Soviets. We do not believe that the British can afford us, so that leaves the Americans." By early May 1945, key members of the V2 development team were in U.S. military custody, turning over 14 tons of technical documents. American forces set out to gather parts, tooling, and support gear to assemble as many as 100 V2s, stuffing rail cars full of equipment for the trip back to the United States. By early September, the first of over 100 German rocket team members began arriving at Fort Bliss, Texas. The fact that many of them were guilty of atrocities committed during the war was quickly covered up in the interest of gaining access to their technical talent and experience. The British were the first to order a post-war launch of the V2 as part of Operation Backfire. Three backfire launches took place in October 1945 on the coast of Germany near the town of Cuxhaven, with Allied experts watching German tactical missile troops demonstrate the V2 under battlefield conditions. Among those in attendance was Sergei Korolev, who would later head the Soviet Union's space program. Korolev would build upon the missile's design by creating the V2-based R1 and R2, his country's first ballistic missiles, and would draw upon V2 technology to build the powerful Vostok and Soyuz boosters. Like von Braun, Korolev was not only a gifted engineer, he was also a remarkable leader. Even as the German rocket team was arriving in America, it was clear that the V2 was already obsolete as a weapon, given the missile's limited range and payload. The defeat of Japan following the atomic bomb drops on Hiroshima and Nagasaki showed that the ballistic missiles of the future would need to carry much heavier nuclear warheads over much greater distances. Almost immediately, von Braun and his team started work on the next generation of battlefield missiles and continued work on anti-aircraft weapons started in the last years of the war. With the Germans arriving in El Paso, 300 boxcars full of V2 parts were on their way to the White Sands Proving Ground in southern New Mexico. While the V2s were useless as weapons, the U.S. Army was quick to realize the research and training potential of the German missiles. The General Electric Company was signed to run V2 launch operations at White Sands, and a science panel was pulled together to oversee the research potential of the rockets, the Upper Atmosphere Research Panel. This group was made up of representatives from the Naval Research Laboratory, GE, the U.S. Army Signal Corps, and leading universities such as Johns Hopkins, Michigan, and Harvard. Their task was to consider proposals from researchers to carry scientific payloads on board the V-2 rockets, such as experiments studying solar radiation, X-ray astronomy, upper atmosphere research, and the new field of space biology. None of the captured V-2 rockets arrived at White Sands in flyable condition, and each rocket had to be individually assembled and tested before flight. Certain parts were in short supply, especially guidance instruments, and U.S. companies were called upon to build replacements. New gyroscopes were sourced from Bendix and Honeywell, while the Douglas Aircraft Company built entire V-2 tail assemblies. On the other hand, many parts were in great supply. The Germans were surprised to find that the Americans had shipped boxcars full of fiberglass insulation over from Europe, material that could easily have been purchased at local stores. American V-2 researchers improved the performance of the rocket throughout the launch program, and by the end of the project, researchers had increased payload capacity by almost half. A test stand was constructed in the nearby Oregon Mountains, and the first static firing of a V-2 rocket in America occurred on March 15, 1946. The first American launch of the rocket was attempted on April 16th from the newly constructed Army Launch Area 1. The flight was not successful. A fin separated from the rocket soon after launch, causing the V-2 to spin out of control, only reaching an altitude of 5 miles. A second launch attempt on May 10th was more successful, carrying a Johns Hopkins University-supplied cosmic radiation experiment to an altitude of 69 miles. Although the flight's Geiger counter and wire recorder failed to return any usable data, the era of V-2 rocket research in America was underway. While the first V-2 flights at White Sands used a standard battlefield warhead, the Naval Gun Factory designed and built a versatile research nose cone that could be fitted with a wide range of scientific instruments. Certain flights were fitted with specialized equipment for more specific applications, such as this University of Michigan upper atmosphere sampling flight. Without a heavy warhead in place, researchers often had to add weight to the nose of the V-2 in order to ensure a stable flight. Many of the research flights carried motion picture and still cameras, some of which were supplied by the National Geographic Society. The Army's Air Research Development Command also participated in the White Sands V-2 program. Many of these flights were known as Project Blossom, an early program designed to study the effects of rocket flight and upper atmosphere exposure to biological payloads, and then recover the payload by parachute. Working with scientists from the nearby Holloman Air Force Base, Blossom flights sent passengers as varied as fruit flies, mice, and even small primates to the edge of space. Blossom Flight No. 1 carried a 9-pound rhesus monkey named Albert, the first animal astronaut. Unfortunately, telemetry showed that Albert probably died before launch, and none of his later animal colleagues survived later flights in the Blossom series due to recovery failures. One of the Blossom flights tested a subscale version of the detachable escape capsule planned for the Bell X-2 research aircraft. The U.S. Navy also took part in the American V-2 flight program, beginning with Operation Sandy, the September 1947 launch of a V-2 from the deck of the aircraft carrier USS Midway. Although the rocket reached an altitude of less than a mile, the Sandy project proved that a missile could be safely launched from the deck of a ship. A later Navy program called Operation Pushover tested the effects of a rocket explosion on board a warship. A simulated deck was constructed on the range at White Sands, and then a fully fueled, flight-ready V-2 was deliberately toppled over and exploded. Perhaps the most ambitious flights of the American V-2 program were the Bumper Wax series, the first flights of a practical two-stage rocket. The V-2 was used as a booster for a modified liquid-fueled Army WAC research rocket designed by a team from the Jet Propulsion Lab at the California Institute of Technology. The bumper WAC combination was designed for both high altitude and high speed research. The WAC slid into rails in the modified nose of the V-2 booster and would be ignited at the appropriate point in the flight profile. The first flight in the bumper series took place at White Sands on May 13, 1948, reaching an altitude of 78 miles. While the next three flights failed, Bumper WAC round B-5 reached an altitude of 244 miles, the highest altitude of any flight in the V-2 series. The Bumper WAC program then moved to a remote launch site on the coast of Florida for the next series of launches. On July 24, 1950, Bumper WAC round B-8 became the first rocket to fly from Cape Canaveral, inaugurating what would become America's most important launch site. Five days later, another bumper flight rose from the same launch pad, reaching a maximum altitude of 31 miles and a speed of Mach 9. The V-2 flight program in America came to an end on September 19, 1952, with the White Sands launch of TF-5, a training flight conducted solely by Army personnel. TF-5 only reached an altitude of 4 miles, closing this early chapter in the story of America's space program. A total of 70 V-2 rockets had been launched in the U.S. after the close of the war. 67 of those flights took place at White Sands, and 68% of those launches were considered successful. In the early days of his career, Wernher von Braun often expressed a hope that his work would someday lead to the exploration of space. Working for the U.S. Army Ballistic Missile Agency, von Braun and his team designed and flew the Redstone and Jupiter rockets, and used that work as the basis for the booster that lofted America's first satellite into space. On January 31, 1958, a Jupiter C booster, a direct descendant of the V-2 missile, put Explorer 1 into orbit. Von Braun would go on to lead the team that designed the Saturn V booster, which helped put men on the moon in July 1969. The legacy of the V-2 is undeniable. It was forged as a weapon of war, killing thousands both on the assembly line and in the targeted cities of Europe, serving an evil regime as a symbol of cruelty and terror. In the post-war years, however, it became a symbol of progress, a powerful research and teaching tool for the generation that would place the first footprints on the surface of the moon.
And there we have it. 80 years ago last week, the first launch of the V-2 from White Sands in New Mexico. Now we're going to have more look back and times after these messages. 88.3 Southern FM. Here on the Space Show this evening, we are turning back time. In late 1957, the Soviet Union launched two satellites, the second of which carried the dog Laika. In mid-1958, a more advanced Sputnik was placed into orbit. 1959 saw three moonshots, the third of which photographed the lunar far side. During 1960, three Korabl Sputniks were orbited. These were tests of what were later called Vostok spacecraft. Early in 1961, two more Korabl Sputniks were orbited carrying dogs. Then, 65 years ago, on 1961, April the 12th, Vostok 1 was launched onto a single orbit of the Earth. Aboard was Yuri Gagarin, the first human in space. Instantly, Gagarin was world famous. This report from the United States' ABC network.
Historic day, one of the most unforgettable of our century, the point of departure for man seeking to reach space. And this man, Yuri Gagarin, major in the Soviet Air Force, is the first to cross the frontier into the unknown of space. 27 years old, suave, handsome, highly trained, married to a medical student, the father of two girls. Occupation, cosmonaut, the world's first. He has now traveled faster, higher, and farther than any man in the history of this planet. And no other man can yet claim the same occupation or distinction. Tonight, all Russia has gone wild with joy. Delirious crowds in the streets of Moscow, Leningrad, and other cities, hailing the triumph of Soviet science over the West. Russia calls it an unparalleled victory of man over the forces of nature, an immense achievement of science and technology, and the triumph of the human mind. And it is indeed all these things. Now the world is asking, what next? What will Russia try to conquer next in this new world of space? And so the pattern of Soviet triumph in space. Where are we ask tonight. Our Project Mercury will get off the ground in its first short manned shot near the end of this month. A short ride, 115 miles to the edge of space. April 28th is the earliest date. As for an orbital flight, like Russia did today, that won't come until near the end of the year, maybe not even until early next year. And how do our Mercury astronauts feel about the Soviet triumph? Disappointed, they all tell us today. Naturally, we wanted to be first. 10 days ago at Mercury headquarters, Langley Field, Virginia, I asked Lieutenant Colonel John Glenn, who may well be our first astronaut into space, how he would feel if the Russians beat us into space.
John, if the Russians get a man up before we do, how would you feel about that?
Well, that's a good question, because we've been asked this many times. There's only one answer to that. It doesn't change our program one bit. This is like saying that because Henry Ford started a new car first, no one else should be in the automobile business today. The General Motors should have dropped out before they started. Well, this is ridiculous, of course, and it's probably a ridiculous example, but the fact that the Russians happen to get a shot off or may not get a shot off a little bit before we do doesn't alter the objectives of our program a bit. Our program is not set up just as a race to space. We're well aware of the international implications of this, but this doesn't alter the step-by-step progression that we want our program to go through to see that man safely starts space exploration. We have our goals. I guess they have theirs, and the fact that they do or do not get a shot off ahead of us will not alter the objects of Project Mercury.
We're not going to change our plan.
No.
In the United Kingdom, Reginald Turnhill was a reporter. He quickly made his way to Moscow.
Well, it was the most phony press conference I've ever attended, and although I put the best gloss on it possible at the time, it was a really unpleasant experience because they gave me a visa in London quickly enough to go to Moscow. And you must remember the Cold War was at its height, the really unpleasant atmosphere between the West and the Soviet Union. We called them the Soviets those days, not the Russians. So finally we got to the questions, and there was this bright young man, very impressive. I was always very impressed with Yuri Gagarin, a very smart young man. Uh-huh. In fact, he was picked, of course, because although they'd selected over 20 cosmonauts and trained, mm-hmm. he was obviously the brightest, most self-assured, and yet he wasn't vain or arrogant. He was a rare human being. Did you land inside the Vostok spacecraft or eject and descend on a parachute, you see? As I said, we desperately wanted to know the answer. It was a very important answer for the Soviets because they wanted to claim this as an aeronautical, international aeronautical record. And to claim this as a record, the pilot had to be in the spacecraft for launch and landing. Mm-hmm. So that was a secondary reason we wanted to know. Uh-huh. And the answer he gave to us, he was pulled down by Academician Blagonrovov, who was sitting in the chair, and he whispered in his ear before he answered. And then Yuri stood up straight and smiled and looked at the audience, and the answer that we got was, whichever way it was, you can see it was successful. There was a roar of laughter, and this set the tone for the whole thing.
And that was Reginald Turnhill, a reporter at the time. And interestingly, I met Reginald in 1972 when I was in London. Anyway, in fact, Gagarin ejected from Vostok 1.
And eject at 23,000 feet. He's 200 miles from his targeted landing site. But Gagarin has survived. In just 108 minutes, he's traveled over 25,000 miles. Gagarin is now a national hero. Less than 5 years after Sputnik, the Soviets have beat the United States to space once again.
When Vostok 1 lifted off, Yuri Gagarin called out on his radio, "Poyekhali," which is Russian for "let's go." Well, when Alan Shepard's Mercury 3 flight was delayed, he radioed, "Light this candle." Well, this song we're going to play now is titled "Poyekhali" and subtitled "Light This Candle," and it conflates those two stories. This is by Kraken Not Stirred, a group from Canada.
Let's go! It became a rallying cry.
Recorded in Canada in 2019, that was Kraken Not Stirred. Now to a bit of poetry, a cosmic poem written by John Heath Stubbs. This was written in the late 1960s. It mentions Yuri Gagarin, who orbited the Earth in 1961 and looks forward to the Apollo lunar landings. But should we be more concerned with earthly problems, is the question it asks.
Cosmic Poem by John Heath Stubbs. Now we're in the seventh decade. Dionysius Exiguus said, that's where we're supposed to be. Of the 20th century, since our redemption was affected, every poet is expected, unless he wishes to lose face, to say something about space. Although, it seems to me, of late, that term is somewhat out of date. The entire area being cluttered, so in some circles it is muttered, with marvelous, irrelevant, and in every sense extravagant. Russo-American hardware, there's precious little space up there, in the immediate vicinity, of poor old Earth. As for infinity, doubtless, that's different. But I would have it quite clearly understood that it is not to be supposed I am in any way opposed to science. She's a lovely thing. For clear-eyed science my harp I'll string. As for the spaceman, I wish them luck. Major Gagarin's a perfect duck. The wild duck, or gargany, is the name's etymology. An excellent husband and father. Forgive me, reader, I feel rather blank on this subject. Space is blank. We have the subject self to thank. It seems my muse cannot absorb it. But she puts poems into orbit, designed to explore the human heart. And we have scarcely made a start to plumb that ultimate abyss, or find out really what it is. The intrepid cosmonauts who fly up above the bright blue sky will not meet the Lord of the Air, but to the clivities of despair that lie inside the heart, he clings, bat-like, you hear his dangerous wings. It's very well that we shall soon be landing chaps upon the moon, she whom we poets specially honor, and planting little flags upon her, and that the next stop will be Venus, and we'll be sharing out between us the planets and the planetoids. Rambling through AZOIC voids. Before we start, it might befit we tidied up this earth a bit. We've got a very ugly bomb. Can blow us all to kingdom come. Unless we mind our P's and Q's. and it will be no earthly use cavorting round the galaxies if, down here, radioactive seas upon an uninhabited shore roll sadly on forevermore. What life may be among the stars, or basks along the canals of Mars, the bug-eyed monsters and puce rabbits, I hope will not adopt our habits. Another fact worth pointing out, in the context of this kickabout, I know of course it's obvious, and do not wish to make a fuss. But still I think we really ought to give the matter serious thought, to save us from undue elation and cosmic self-congratulation. Is this, well, more than half the mortals who pass beyond the womb's dark portals and blindly struggle into birth here on this unromantic earth, to grow up under mundane skies, go hungry to bed and hungry rise, and are neither healthy, wealthy nor wise. Outer space can wait its turn. The human being's my concern.
And from the United Kingdom, that was an automatic reading of John Heath Stubbs' cosmic poem. Our next poet also comes from the United Kingdom. This is George Barker. And it was written after the first man to orbit the Earth, Yuri Gagarin, died in an aircraft accident on 1968, March the 27th, at age 34. This is In Memory of Yuri Gagarin.
In Memory of Yuri Gagarin, by George Barker. At the death of this small man, the stars throw down a handful of dark years, and the moon withdrew into her rotating cave of shadows and wept a little. The dog star hid its head, and the Leonids like mice ran squeaking over the zodiac. The globe-eyed ghosts of our house of planets crept out from cold lairs and huddled together as the ash of the dog that died in the sky fled, seeking to follow its master, this dead man free in free fall at last. And death said, I take him to me so that no dishonor can now or ever accrue upon this man or this name, Yuri Gagarin.
To this day, Yuri Gagarin's life is celebrated in what's called Yuri's Night. This is by Scott Rodell, celebrating Yuri's Night.
Oh, one to wonder how it feels. I can bet I'm not the only.
From Bayside, Melbourne, this is 88.3 Southern FM.
Where we are turning back time. In this case, to 1981. 20 years to the day after Yuri Gagarin's flight, the first space shuttle was launched. Piloted by John Young and Robert Crippen, STS-1 made 36 orbits of the Earth 45 years ago. This space shuttle orbiter was called Columbia. In 1983, just 2 years after that flight, Leslie Fish and Arlen Robbins sang this song, which was called Fly Columbia.
Fly Columbia,
fly Columbia.
Thunder toward tomorrow on an oxygen stream. Thunder toward tomorrow, fire, flame, and rocket song. Mark a new time of man, booster candles light the dawn. Fly Columbia,
fly Columbia.
Foundation of the future, courier of dreams. Thunder on. Sunshine brightens the horizon, tension rings the morning haze. The shuttle standing proud against the wind. Knows the distant stars, her delta wings will never grace. Countdown pulses race, the launch begins. Fly Columbia,
fly Columbia.
Thunder toward tomorrow on an oxygen stream. Thunder toward tomorrow, fire, flame, and rocket song. Mark a new time of man, booster candles light the dawn. Fly Columbia,
fly Columbia.
Foundation of the future, courier of dreams. Thunder on. Columbia, the promise of better days to come. Columbia, new mistress of the sky. Sail in orbit free, track the moon and chase the sun. Fly Columbia for humankind, fly. Fly Columbia,
fly Columbia.
Thunder toward tomorrow on an oxygen stream. Thunder toward tomorrow, fire, flame, and rocket song. Mark a new time of man, booster candles light the dawn. Fly Columbia,
fly Columbia.
Foundation of the future, career of dreams. Thunder on.
Leslie Fish and Arlen Robbins there. Now, we've got a little thing called Space Shuttle Columbia. It's read by Wayne Soich and written by Donna Kane from Canada.
Hi, I'm Wayne Soich. My partner Donna Kane has asked me to read a poem from her new book, Orrery. I'm going to read a poem today called Space Shuttle Columbia. Whatever he was thinking when he snapped a photo of a sunrise from the shuttle with a damaged left wing is anybody's guess. The picture shows the Earth in the foreground, rising from behind the planet, its blinding white star, a fuse of light above the Earth's top edge. And the Earth, well, with the ocean's baby blues, the atmospheric fluffs of white, the morning's pinkish glow, it looks brand new. All its fingers and all its toes. All day the astronauts, while experimenting with silkworms, carpenter ants, and nematodes, sent pictures like this. Some of us scanned for alien life, others for a glimpse of the wing's leading edge. Engineers sent 8 requests to mission control. 8 were shrugged off. The grays, not important. And so what if it was? How would you tell 7 astronauts you knew their return was doomed? When every last one of them went up in smoke, only the nematodes survived. Did you know that nematodes cover so much of Earth's mass, if all other matter were removed, the shape of mountains would remain in nematodes. The shape of trees would stand in ghostly rows.
The tragic end of the Columbia. So we've looked at the beginning and end of that space shuttle. Now, on 1991, April the 5th, the space shuttle Atlantis was launched on a mission called STS-37. 10 years after the first space shuttle launch, STS-1, this mission's primary task was to deploy into orbit the Gamma Ray Observatory. But all did not go to plan. 35 years ago, as the space shuttle crew of 4 men and 1 woman prepared the 16-ton astronomy satellite for release. After the 5-day mission, the crew described what the problem was and how 2 of them had to do a spacewalk to manually fix the problem.
On flight day 2, we set up some preparations for deploying the Gamma Ray Observatory. Those were 3 main types. One was getting the Gamma Ray Observatory all checked out in cooperation with the Payload Operations Control Center and Goddard Space Flight Center in Greenbelt. The second was to prepare ourselves by pre-breathing pure oxygen so that when Jerry and I went down to 5 PSI in the suits, we wouldn't get the bends. The third was preparing the suits for the EVA, and Jerry's starting that here. We checked out all the suits in case there was a contingency EVA. On the third flight day here, Linda had grappled the grow with the arm, and here we are preparing to release the latches which hold the Gamma Ray Observatory into the cargo bay. And we are releasing the 4th and 5th of those latches.
After we checked out the pocket, checked out the systems as much as possible, and Jade released those latches, I used the arm to start lifting GRU out of the bay. Now, this is a 35,000-pound payload, the heaviest we've ever moved about on orbit with the arm, and while it doesn't weigh anything, it has all those properties of mass, so you have to move it very, very slowly, except time seems speeded up a bit when you're actually doing this in the aft flight deck of the orbiter. So you can see there all the appendages are still stowed. The arrays are folded up like accordions on the left and right side, and you can see the end of the high-gain antenna dish underneath there still folded up. We moved it straight up out of the bay to what we called a low hover position, and then put the arm into an automatic mode that basically just moved it a bit in translation, but mostly pitched it over about 110 degrees. And once we got the arm up to that position, that was where it was to have stayed until a release. Here you see it after the first solar array has been deployed, and that went just like clockwork. Matter of fact, the whole arm ops worked very smooth, and we were on the timeline here. The other solar array you see actually in the process of being deployed. And the next step in the deploy process after we maneuvered to an attitude, Steve did that to start charging these, was to deploy the high-gain antenna boom.
Once we realized that the nominal and several other attempts would not release the high-gain antenna boom, it was time to begin preparations for the EVA means of unlatching and deploying the boom. Here you can see Steve assisting Jay with his lower torso assembly, while I was in the airlock helping to prepare Jerry, who was already inside of the hard upper torso of the suit. The EVA was one that we had trained for and prepared very thoroughly for. GRO was designed for a lot of EVA work to be done on it, and we performed a unscheduled or quick response EVA to take care of a problem that someone fortunately had foreseen. Here you can see the 2 crew members exiting the airlock to begin their work.
Well, as Ken said, we had thoroughly trained to be prepared to react to spacecraft contingencies such as this, and we were out on the spacecraft very quickly, surveyed the situation, did not see anything that should have been causing the boom to hang up, and with some relatively easy force inputs, were able to jostle the boom free. Analysis now says that probably there was just a little bit of thermal cover on the boom that was hanging up on some of the spacecraft structure. I think at this point I yelled gleefully, "It's free, it's free." As far as I was concerned, when that boom came free, that made my flight for me. It was the only reason that that we went on in this spacewalk, and with the successful freeing of this boom, we then translated over to the other side of the spacecraft, where Jay and I completed the task of putting the boom into its on-orbit position. You can see this other view now. I'm in a foot restraint, and Jay is supporting me and watching my legs to make sure that we don't do any damage to the spacecraft as I very slowly and gingerly raised the boom up to its full deployed position, and then with a wrench was able to drive a mechanical system over center, which locked that boom into its on-orbit position. Then Jay and I quickly left the spacecraft so that the POC could turn on the spacecraft's transmitters and receivers and fully check out the spacecraft in preparation for release. And during that time, both Jay, as you see here, and me in the other window had a chance to come up and say hi to the folks inside and see what they were doing. I think they were eating at this time, Jay, if I remember right,
while
we were outside working.
We were busy.
We're saying hi through the window to them there.
Well, some point after that, as a matter of fact, it was a good bit of time later, the arrays, we moved it back up to the release position. The arrays were fully charged. The POC finished testing out all the systems. It looked really great. We were ready to release GROW, which we do by opening the snares on the arm and very carefully backing away so as not to provide any rates on it, although a 35,000 payload is pretty stable up there in space. That's what we found out. We waited, and as soon as the arm was clear, Ken called that to Steve.
When the arm was clear, of course, it was called to me. We just reset the digital autopilot and put some pulses in to move slowly away from the GROW. It appeared to be as slow as you see in this film, so slowly that I checked our displays to make sure it was the right rate. But it was about a half a foot a second, which is just a slow drift away. There's a little thing you see fly by in this picture, which caught my attention at first, too. It was a piece of debris in the lens of the camera itself, which... Now, the first time I saw it, I thought there was a piece of something coming off the orbiter of the spacecraft, but it wasn't, of course. We slowly drifted away and watched it go away from us and then set up for two more separation burns, the second of which was about 22 or so minutes after this first one, and it was out of plane a couple of feet a second just to get out of the orbital plane of GROW. Here you see it going away. And the third was called a posigrade separation burn, which got us above and behind the orbit of GROW. And then later we came back to within 8 miles of it for a separate test.
Later renamed the Compton Gamma Ray Observatory in honor of Arthur Compton, the four instruments operated for almost 9 years. In June of 2000, it was deorbited over the Pacific Ocean. Now, during those 9 years, it discovered the isotropic distribution of gamma ray burst events. It mapped the distribution of aluminium in the Milky Way. It discovered blazar active galactic nuclei as the primary source of the highest energy cosmic gamma rays. And it discovered bursting pulsars. That was the Gamma Ray Observatory, launched 35 years ago. This has been The Space Show. Thank you very much for Richard.